Miss Marcus come in. She was wearing a beret. She'll be back in a minute. Okay. We're on the air. That's what a thumbs up means. Okay. All right. Delta Stewardship Council is called to order. Thank you very much. I note the presence of Mr. Grindstaff. Mr. Grindstaff was not feeling well yesterday. And if he's not feeling well at any time today, he will be ordered to go home in chains if necessary. So you behave yourself, Joe Grindstaff.
Thank you.
Ms. Marcus is somewhere in the building. She'll be in shortly. Let's delay the vote on the quorum. I note Mr. Nordhoff, Mr. Fiorini, and I are here. Ms. Marcus is, as I say, in the building somewhere. Now, yesterday we ended in the middle of our discussion on the Delta plan. We're going to delay that part of the presentation until we have our lead scientist report. Hello, Dr. Dom. And then the Independent Science Board report as well. So, members, if you would be good enough, please, to go to item number 11, the lead scientist report. Dr. Dom. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair, I do want to, before we start, point out that there is a cake at the back of the room, and that cake is in recognition of the chair's birthday, which is today.
Yeah.
And
go home, Joe.
Are you going to sing?
I am not going to sing.
Yes.
And also, Mr. Nordhoff, whose birthday was last week, as I understand it, and we missed Miss Marcus, whose birthday,
happy birthday
was in January. Is that correct? Yes.
There's a consolidated.
So anyway, there is
a consolidated birthday cake.
There is a consolidated. And anybody who gets a sugar craving, that's what it's there for. So
okay,
feel free to go back.
People in the audience can share that too, right?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Intended for everyone.
All right, let's establish a quorum, starting with Mr. Nordhoff, please.
Mark is present.
Fiorini here.
Eisenberg here. Okay, we have a quorum. Dr. Dom.
Thank you, and happy birthday.
Thank you.
What I'd like to do this morning is take about 15 or 20 minutes and just give you an overview of the 2010 proposal solicitation package and where we are in the process, and also highlight a little bit of the types of research we're recommending for funding that I think will provide useful information moving forward for the council, and a little bit about the process about how we got to the point where we are now. Let me start with a more general overview perspective of why support scientific research in the Delta. There is a lot of resources that go on an annual basis to required monitoring and measurements, but quite often those measurements are generating lots of data on status and trends, but the kind of information that you need to address causes and effects, to develop the modeling tools and to develop the decision support systems to use that information, and the kind of synthesis, integration, and communication that needs to come out of that information often goes wanting. And I think the research that we're proposing to fund will fill some of the needs in those areas. And that's one of the reasons, I think, why we try to put resources out to the best of the scientific community that we can engage in working in the Delta, and go through a fairly rigorous review process to select those very best proposals and recommend funding for those proposals. So just to give you a brief overview on the proposal solicitation package process, when I arrived as the lead scientist in July of 2008, that was to be my first and foremost task, was to get a proposal solicitation package completed. We had had one in 2004 and one in 2006. The idea was we'd have one in 2008 and then again another one in 2010. So we went through the process of actually drafting up some of the key areas that we felt needed some resources to improve our knowledge base and decrease some of the uncertainty, some of the information that we were using for decision making in the Delta. We went through a process of getting public comment on those topics. We had a stakeholder driven topic selection panel where we coalesced on four topics that all felt were very much in need of additional resources. We had a public comment then on those four topics, and basically put out a proposal solicitation package in December of 2008, and a few weeks later we're faced with the bond freeze. So basically we just simply took the deadline off and left the information available to everyone and basically waited until we knew that we had the resources to actually re-engage. We finally got that go-ahead here a few months ago. We basically set a deadline for the proposals of the end of June 2010. We received 49 proposals. We went through an administrative internal review to make sure the proposals contained the materials that were required in the proposal solicitation package. We then engaged in a process where all proposals were reviewed by external experts that we selected really on a national and international basis. We made sure that we got two and preferably three, in some cases more than three, external reviews of every proposal that was received. We then constituted a panel of 13 individuals, experts that we felt represented the kinds of research that was being considered. They met in January, and that review panel basically came forward with recommendations of the 49 proposals that we support, 13 of those proposals. We went through the budgets then and the review process, made some adjustments in a few cases to the budgets based on input from the review process, and we have now posted that information on those 13 proposals. Those 13 proposals are basically are 3-year research awards. The total asking price for those for those 13 proposals for the 3-year period of time is about $7.1 million. The public comment time period is ongoing. It'll end today, and then once the comments are received on the proposals, we'll address those, and then plan to come back to you as a council at your second of your March meetings and ask for your approval to move forward with the contracting of these 13 proposals.
In late March,
correct.
For confirmation of whatever you're proposing.
And if we get your approval on these 13 proposals, then we will move ahead with the contracting and hope to get the resources available to the researchers so they can start work this summer. So that's basically the timeline. The list of 13 proposals that are recommended for support are in your packet. I did want to spend just a couple minutes highlighting some of the key attributes of the proposals so that you get a sense of some of the kinds of things that these researchers are hoping to do, and hopefully with some clear links as to why I think this information will be useful to the council moving forward.
I assume PI stands for primary...
it stands for principal investigator. Yes.
Okay.
Another one of those acronyms that we...
confused with.
Yes. Okay. So the 13 principal investigators, again, in I think almost all cases, these are teams. These are not just one individual. They're in some cases, they're very large teams. But I just wanted to highlight one of the things that we had these four topic areas that we were highlighting, and those four topic areas were native fish biology and ecology. The second area was food webs of key delta species and their relationships to water quality and other drivers. I think you heard a little bit from the EPA yesterday about some of these kinds of issues. The third area was coupled hydrologic and ecological models. And the fourth area is the development of decision support systems to help with management and decision-making within the Delta. We got proposals from all of those areas, and in the package of recommended proposals, we find all of them represented. In fact, we have two of the proposals that actually claim by the investigators that they're going to do all four. We'll see whether that's true, but certainly we got a good diversified package. I think we had something like 7, 9, 7, and 7 in those four areas. So I think the proposals do represent new research on all four of those topics in a fairly balanced manner. I did want to highlight then just a few things about their proposals. I'm going to put them into boxes, even though in many cases they extend beyond a single box. But I did just want to highlight a few of these, and I'll be happy to address additional details, but I'm just going to give you a one or two sentence summary of each of the projects. Under the topic of native fish biology and ecology, we had four projects, one by Catherine Boyer at San Francisco State University, focuses on the native submerged aquatic vegetation that exists in Sassoon Marsh and around some of the islands in the Western Delta. These are areas that appear to be important for native fish biology, but we know very little about their utilization, about the kinds of food resources that might be associated with them. And the recommendation was to fund a pilot project for her to begin to actually look at these habitat types. We also think these habitat types may be very indicative indicator systems for salinity regimes that occur in Sassoon Marsh and in the Western Delta. And so if salinity begins to change in those regions, I think these are likely to be communities that might be sensitive to those salinity variability. So that was one of the projects that we're planning to fund. Richard Cannon at UC Davis has a project that is very interested in the effects of temperature and salinity changes on Delta smelt, and he will be looking at this at the genetic level. So how do these fish actually function when they are stressed by either salinity or by temperature? And so that's basically some of the new molecular techniques that use microarrays that look at thousands and thousands of genes basically within these organisms, see how they respond to these kind of stressors in the system. The third one is a study by Fred Feyer and colleagues to look at Sacramento splittail. This is a species of concern. Turns out there's been a new population found in the Petaluma Napa area, and there's interest in seeing how they compare to the Delta population. And the project is going to actually try to really get at a lot of aspects of the life history of this fish using telemetry, genetics, physiology, and then modeling of the life cycle history of this organism. The fourth project in this category is by Peter Moyle at the University of California, Davis. He has an outstanding 30-year data set of fish populations in Sassoon Marsh, and the project is really an attempt to use this long-term data set to address issues of what is it about the physical variability and structure of the habitats in Sassoon Marsh that make it such a good location to find many of our native fish species. Many of our remnant native fish species populations are well represented in this kind of habitat. So those are the four proposals that sort of fit under that general category. Under the category of food webs and key delta species and their relationships to water quality and other drivers, the first project I'll highlight is a project by Patricia Gleibert and colleagues from San Francisco State University. The question here is, how do changes in the amount of nutrients, the chemical form of those nutrients, and the ratio of nitrogen and phosphorus to key nutrients affect what kind of algae are in the Delta and in Sassoon Bay and Sassoon Marsh, and basically try to get a better understanding of what's controlling the base of the food web out in the Delta. The second project I want to highlight is Alex Parker's. He's at San Francisco State University. This is a project very much focused on Microcystis. Microcystis is a toxic algae that is blooming within the Delta, started about a decade ago. And he's basically trying to figure out why the blooms develop, identifying which of the bloom strains are toxic and what controls their toxicity, and how do they affect the food webs within the Delta. So this is the Alex Parker proposal. Third proposal in this area is one by Donald Weston from University of California at Berkeley. This is a project that is really looking at pyrethroid insecticides and looking at it from a food web perspective and from its effect on juvenile fish populations. He'll focus on the American River, where quite commonly toxic levels, basically lethal levels of pyrethroids are found for some of the indicator aquatic invertebrates that toxicologists use. But the question is, really, does this have an effect on the extant food web that's in the river? And so he'll be focusing on the organisms that are actually in the community of invertebrates that these fish feed upon. Yes,
Chris, just as an example, how long will that study take?
These are all 3-year projects.
All 3 years.
Okay. Yeah. Now, clearly, information will come out during the period of time. We encourage these people to both make public communications and write this stuff up. But, yeah, these are 3-year investments.
And we'll be funding the U.S. Geological Survey?
The one study that has to do with the U.S. Geological Survey will go to the U.S. Geological Survey and their collaborators. It's a multifaceted, includes people from Scripps Institution of Oceanography and Stanford and a variety of other universities. So, yeah.
Mr. Natoli?
Yeah. Question, Cliff. But the title of this study, you talk about pyrethroids, but basically starts out impact of urbanization. And again, pyrethroids aren't necessarily just associated with urbanization, I wouldn't think. But I mean,
it actually turns out that the major source of pyrethroid insecticides in aquatic systems appears to be urban and suburban regions.
Well, again, just back to the comments, though, what they use for vector control, I mean, that's not always in the urban settings. That's in the rural. You can be in a very rural agricultural setting to utilize those types of products. I'm saying it may be associated with household application or yard application or such. It's, again, if I draw that conclusion, that if it's urban and suburban, you're using the same products, though, in a more rural setting to control populations of mosquitoes. Is that correct?
It's used. It's increasingly being used in a lot of areas within California. It's replacing one of the banned pesticides. Don Weston has done a lot of survey work to find out where the concentrations are the highest, and it turns out that it is in these urban and suburban areas that he's finding the highest concentrations.
Okay.
But certainly they are associated with wastewater out of wastewater treatment plants. You're certainly right. It's being used for vector control. There's quite a variety of potential sources for this.
Okay.
I think, to be fair, most of his work has been done on the American River.
He's done some surveys in other areas, but yes, that's correct. That's correct. He has many of his studies have focused on the American River.
And this one will be as well.
This one will be as well, although this one adds very much a native community of aquatic invertebrates, not just test organisms in the laboratory, and it'll also have some work where he'll actually be using juvenile fish and see whether it's affecting their diet.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, and then finally in this area of food webs, the last one is a proposal by Monica Winder. She's really looking at the zooplankton community in the Delta, and the zooplankton community is now largely dominated by non-native species of zooplankton, and she's really looking at the nutritional quality of this of these groups of organisms and how they're linked both as a food source to the juvenile fish and what they're feeding on relative to the planktonic algal and bacterial community that they feed upon within the system. She's actually one of our fellows that has now moved on to a young faculty position. The third area is a coupled hydrologic and ecosystem models. We have two in that category. One is the Ray Hilborn study from the University of Washington. This is a study that is going to attempt to integrate all the salmon river population in the Sacramento River into a model that would be used to address how water management and fisheries management within the catchment is affecting salmon population levels within the Sacramento River. The other one in this category is the large one you were asking about, Hank, which is involves the U.S. Geological Survey, but a large number of other collaborators. This actually is taking some of the leading modelers who have been working on modeling within the Delta from a variety of different perspectives, from a climate perspective, from a hydrology perspective, from a hydrodynamics perspective, from a sediment transport perspective, primary production, food webs, fish populations, bringing them together and trying to make these models talk to each other and link so that they can actually test out scenarios of climate variability or climate change or look at issues of altered conveyance or changed conveyance and how it would affect the Delta as a whole. It's a very ambitious project, linking nine different types of modeling efforts into a more synthetic.
But all world. Ecosystem types of modeling?
Well, a lot of it is hydrologic and basically downscaling climate predictions to a catchment or a watershed basis like the Sacramento River. There is, and there's also one of the big concerns of the reviewers was that there's uncertainty associated with each of these models. How do you understand then the uncertainty when you link a whole bunch of them together? And so really trying to understand also the confidence we can have in these models when we start coupling them. And then in the last category, the water and ecosystem management decision support system development, there are two projects. One is Stephen Monasmith from Stanford University. He wants to develop, with the help of colleagues, an open source three-dimensional hydrodynamic model. The reason for the importance for three dimensions is that you have both salt and temperature stratification that do occur within the Delta, and you also have very complex mixing processes that go on at the junctions where various basically channels meet within the delta, understanding the dynamics in a tidally driven system in these areas is quite challenging, and if you don't have three-dimensional capability, you really can't resolve a lot of the kinds of mixing and transport issues that you have there. So the development of this and then using basically tidal variation, atmospheric forcing like winds and things like that, river flows, and alternatives for water diversions to understand how that would affect things like the salinity regime, the temperature regime, and the flow regime of the delta. So, and one of the things I know we're really encouraging him is that the development of this tool be something that he also then disseminates and communicates so that others can use it effectively. So that's why it's open source, and we're asking him to make sure he has a strong communications and teaching component. And then finally, the last one is actually a small study. It's by Russell Perry, actually, and again, basically looking at some, quite a bit of data has been generated since 2006 using telemetry on sort of the choice of juvenile Chinook salmon as they work their way through the delta, but it really hasn't been analyzed in a lot of in detail in a systematic way. And he has a lot of experience having done this in the Columbia River, and he wants to bring those tools and capability and apply that here in the delta. And so then he wants to come up with basically information then on how you would make decisions about, for example, whether you close certain gates or whether you route water through certain areas or whether you try to maintain certain types of flows in certain regions of the delta. So that's where the decision support system part comes in. So these are the 13 projects of the 49 that were proposed that we are recommending that either partial or full support be given, and we'll come back in a month and ask you for an action item, but at this point in time, I'd be happy to address any questions about any of the proposals.
Yeah, just on the last one, Cliff, because we had that request last fall to indicate some support for closure of the gates in the October time frame, and so, again, I guess there was some consideration that might be something that we put forward to this year, because I guess they were going to pull some water out of the McCollumy. East Bay Mud, I believe, was the party at that point.
Well, East Bay Mud was one of them, but it was a federal facility, not a state facility, and the parties who came to us, which included one of the fishing organizations and another environmental organization, had been out of touch with federal officials for 6 or 7 months, and my recollection is we were 2.5 months away, or 2.5 weeks away from the deadline by the time they came to us.
Yeah.
We communicated with the federal officials, asked them to meet. I have not gotten a report back from any of the parties as to whether they've met and whether the Bureau, I think it's a Bureau decision, isn't it, Joe? I've gotten no information how the Bureau is evaluating that request.
And again, the reason I asked the question, though, is that if he's conducting a study, that obviously would have some relevancy, I would think, to what he was looking at, because you would... In the midst of his study, there might be a change in the way the gates have been operated for several years or different timing and so forth. I guess it'd be important to know, though, because if he has a certain regimen for how he's going to do his late fall studies, that if there's some consideration for changing the way things have been operated, at least in recent times, then I guess he would be kept apprised of that. But I just know we had that request coming for us.
I think maybe a good way forward on this is he's actually one of the things we've asked him before we actually support the proposal is that we want him to provide us written documentation that he's going to be able to get his hands on all the data that he's hoping to get his hands on, which is all of the basically telemetry work that's been done since 2006. And then he's going to put it through this analysis mechanism that he's developed for studies in the Columbia River. It seems like we should link him up and what he's doing with this group of folks.
Okay, thanks.
Randy?
Cliff, thanks. Obviously, our charge is to find as comprehensive a set of solutions as we can to the problems that are plaguing the Delta. And the science work is at the core of a lot of that. There, it strikes me that you have issues like microcystis, potential toxicity to invertebrates from pyrethroids, things like that. At what point are we satisfied scientifically that these are problems and then shift to studying what to do about it? Or invasive species is another one. It doesn't show up on here, but we recognize that it either is potentially a problem, or we verify that, yeah, it is a problem. Is that work that should come through the PSP, or do we need to move on then to mechanical engineers, or what? How do we get to a solution from the science?
Well, this is a tricky interface between science and policy. I mean, you're going to have uncertainty throughout the process, but you're going to use the best information base you can gather. This is certainly, I would posit, as these are examples of where the information base will be improved, but some of these things are not going to await a three-year study. You're going to have to make some decisions, but you are doing this adaptively, so you can adaptively make decisions that you might alter once the information from these kinds of investments and research are in. But ultimately, you all have to make the decisions, but you need our input, and you need the input from the scientific and engineering community to help with that decision-making process.
Does that mean that we're going to see some of the procedural answers suggested by the chapter to be developed on adaptive management and science for the Delta Plan?
We've drafted that chapter, and we're in the process of working with you to figure out how to best incorporate it into the plan.
Okay, and we're going to be seeing that in the next draft, I assume. Is that correct? Okay. Yeah, I actually look forward to it. I think Randy's question of how you take scientific information and translate it into what is an inherently politically influenced administrative process is really hard, is very hard.
I'll share with the council a paper written back in the early 1990s, and Ray Hilborn was one of the co-authors, one of the people we're proposing to support here, which basically focused on fisheries resource management and this delicate issue of science and policy interface and how to make progress and move forward on that. And certainly the issue of uncertainty raises its head repeatedly in this, but it also was, they argued pretty persuasively that you still have to make decisions and move forward in the face of uncertainty, and then here's how to marshal the best evidence that you can. And I think to some extent the way you're approaching these fact sheets where you're basically trying to bring the information base quite clearly to your findings is one way to begin that process.
Felicia?
I welcome that discussion, having gone through it in different forms over the years. I do think this issue of how much the fact that there's always going to be some uncertainty but you have to act is an important one, because people use the notion of certainty versus uncertainty as a weapon mm-hmm. in fighting things they don't like. And at a certain point, mm-hmm. I mean, we never would have regulated smoking. Mm-hmm. I mean, it took until just not that long ago to find the actual causal link, but we had tons of epidemiological information. So I think it's inherent in any activity like this, just as it is in regulation, to figure out that path. So I'm thrilled you have a good paper on it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the other classic example is that in the 80s we decided to study acid rain, even though we knew it was a problem, and we studied it for a decade. Probably not the most efficient use of resources, but ultimately the decision was made to regulate that, and clearly the ecosystems in the northeastern United States have shown substantive improvement from that.
I keep going back to, is it Dr. Weems' comment at the last Delta conference? He's one of our independent science board members, where he was arguing the position that best available science, at least in a policy context, is also answered by the, well, it's good enough.
Good enough.
It's good enough to make a decision. And I that doesn't have the elevated tones of great science weight, but, you know, as practical matter, what we've been asked to do is make recommendations or take actions that come pretty close to that terminology.
Yep, and your next speaker, who is the chair of your independent science board, is, you know, they're marshaling their resources to help you with this kind of effort, and I think that's exactly what he's going to talk about, is how the independent science board is going to help with the Delta Plan.
Yeah. Ms. Gray.
Good morning, Dr. Dom. Just kind of want to go back to what Randy was saying about how do we translate information into good decisions, and I think the perception that the public has of this council, that we are using the best available science when we make decisions, and that we're looking at a balanced decision-making process. And I think this morning your projects is an example of that, because I'm happy to see that you've balanced the 13 projects under your topic subjects, and I think that's an indication that we're on the right track, and I understand adaptive management, we change as we see fit. But I just wanted to congratulate you this morning for presenting projects that really are balanced as we look at our co-equal goals. Thank you.
Hank.
Cliff, you're probably not the appropriate person to direct this question to, but do we have any idea, any reliable statistics on the amount of groundwater in California?
You know, you had a speaker at your last meeting, the woman from the U.S. Geological Survey, who I think gave you a lot of good information.
It was a very wide range, as I recall, from 111 million acre feet to 800
million. We spend an awful lot of time not monitoring our groundwater, so being able to say, well, how much we have and how much we're using is going to be a major challenge, I think.
Is that something, is that a study that you would undertake with some funding from here, or would it be someone else?
Well, there's a variety of ways of looking at these problems. There's the local, and then the regional, and then the large scale. And some of the more interesting work of late has been these large scale satellite-based measurements that actually use gravity anomalies to assess how much water is being extracted from large groundwater systems around the world. And there has been work on the Central Valley, for example, that was just recently published. I can provide you that paper.
Fairly accurate.
Joe probably remembers the numbers better. Something on the order of 3 million acre feet a year over the last 5 years or so was being taken.
What they said actually was that it was, let me remember this accurately, it was 5 million acre feet a year over 4 year, each per year for the last 4 years from 2006 to 2010. And that if you combined it from 1998 through 2010, over 12 years, it was 40 million acre feet total.
The paper was just recently published in Geophysical Research Letters, and I can forward
so,
it to
and,
the
and council. There was some confusion because the press reported 40 million acre feet in 4 years. And so Kayvon's not here, but we actually had Kayvon Sam, one of our engineers, call and talk to the author of the paper and make sure that he understood the
numbers. That was the Orange County Register article.
Yes.
This says about 2 million acre feet for the last 5 or 8 years.
Yeah.
I mean, if we only have 10, I mean, that's a problem. If we have 800
in terms of how
feet,
much
it's no big deal.
We have accessible groundwater statewide. Again, Kayvon found this number from an early report, somewhere around 450 million acre feet of accessible groundwater, usable groundwater. And so if we are, as a state, overdrafting 5 million acre feet a year, then we potentially could go a long time doing that. Of course, it depends on the area you're in. You may be in one area where you're overdrafting a lot, and you may not be able to do it as long as you
could. It depends on the drought as well.
Yeah, it depends on exactly where you're at and what how much water there is in the area where you're overdrafting that water supply. So,
are you satisfied to take those data with 450?
I am satisfied that it is within 20%. Of accurate, as I am satisfied that the numbers from the professor at UC Irvine and from USGS are probably within 20% of being accurate. So if you add all those numbers together, the Central Valley, I believe, is somewhere between 2 and 4 million acre feet per year. That's how much we're overdrafting in the Central Valley over. And that's a long, that's a large area over the last 10 or 12 years. It's a big, it's a large area and kind of a wide number there, but still, I think that's about right.
Yeah, I think on the macro level, those data are interesting, but not very actionable because it is regional, isn't it?
I think it is, and I think that is why it's hard to make a state policy based on what happens in any given area. And even when I talk about the Central Valley is divided into many, many much smaller sub-basins, and you can find this basin here that's doing really, really well and this area here where they're not doing as well. And areas, we had a meeting with DWR the other day where they talked about, well, they've seen 6 meters of subsidence because of overdraft in one area. So that's that area's clearly got serious problems but it, you can't generalize. And so whatever the council does, I would suspect we're not going to want to just generalize and say this is
true. Are we relying primarily on satellites to get these data?
That's one of the paper that does the regional assessment is using satellites, but then the more regional is actually based on well measurements.
And the state passed a law at the same time as they passed the law forming this council for the first time in history to actually go out and start measuring groundwater elevations. So we should start having data on that within the next couple of years that actually will allow us to look more carefully at where we specifically have the most problems. So while we're slow, I think we're getting where we have to go.
I think Randy has some light to shed on this issue.
No, I was just going to point out that legislation calls for the reporting of groundwater so that we don't have to depend upon satellites and speculation. We'll have actual data. And it'll probably take about 5 years to gather enough information and see what the trends are.
Well, wait a minute. I thought it only mandated elevation reporting. It doesn't require usage reporting.
That's accurate, but just elevation reporting will give us a lot of data about how much water is being used, because you can calculate based on if the water table is dropped, how much water has been used in any area. So I think we'll have a lot more information as we move ahead.
Yeah, one comment I'll make is that when the National Water Act was passed in Australia in 2007 to move forward with the process of allocating flows within the Murray-Darling Basin, it was required in statute that a coupled groundwater surface water modeling be done in each of the catchments in the Murray-Darling Basin for them to move forward with their decision making, because the need for that kind of coupled groundwater surface water information was preeminent for making the decisions, the hard decisions they're having to make in that basin.
Okay, Ms. Marcus, Felicia, did you? Okay. Cliff, thank you very much. We'll see you next month. Dr. Norgaard. This is file item 12, members. File item 12.
So,
how are you, sir?
Doing well.
You were a little wet when you came in this morning, I know.
I've had half an hour to dry out, so I'm in good shape, and happy birthday. So I think the Delta Independent Science Board has stayed out of trouble since the release of the stressors report. We had a teleconference call on February 18th, largely to set up our schedule as to how we would be responding to the drafts. We had at that time only had the first draft in hand for a few days, and were a little frustrated that we had a first draft without references, and it's kind of hard to do science with what we had there. Joe saved the day by saying, but by Wednesday, we'll have the basis of the findings. So the board now has material.
Oh, a rough cut out of that.
It's tremendous. It's a tremendous addition to have the parts put together since the first draft, at least for the parts that are in the first draft. And so we are reading these as of last night, and I was reading them on the train coming up this morning, and it gives us material to work with.
Did you see this?
The board is meeting on March 3rd and 4th in person. March 3rd will be split between working criteria, discussing criteria for how we're going to evaluate the quality of the science. We'll be looking at how the IPCC does it. We'll look to how the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment did it. We'll be looking at the approach in DREERIP, and then in the document itself, there's a suggested approach. So I think we'll be taking the request that we evaluate the quality of the science systematically. I think we'll be able to respond to that. I don't think we'll come up with something as strong as, say, IPCC, where they have 90% probability that this information is accurate. Even those are very subjective statements to which they put numbers, but we will certainly work with the material we have systematically. So our plan is to then spend the rest of March 3rd discussing the document and the findings and the connection, the quality of the science. We have assigned different chapters to different combinations of board members, and then spend March 4th writing, and we'll take home what we can. Mike Healy and I will then, as we did with the stressors report, synthesize, clean up. We can individually go back to board members on their individual parts to make sure that we're, you know, that they've done as much as they can and we've completed the task as well as we can. But we can't circulate a document to all of the board members without posting it publicly. We're hoping to post a document by March 10th. We've been warned that the second draft will incorporate whatever we post on March 10th. And even though it has not been approved until when we have a conference call, March 16th. And so we've, you know, a lot of our teleconference call on February 18th was just scheduling all of this and sort of realizing the consequences of what we were doing.
Yeah. Or members, if you haven't taken a look at the meeting notice for the Independent Science Board teleconference for the last meeting in February, you ought to do it because it's an illustration of how widely we have reached to get scientific opinion that the law requires that if you teleconference in, the site of your teleconferencing has to be added. So we had sites in Singapore, Virginia, Puerto Rico, Maryland, Washington, California, and Oregon.
And we missed our member in Australia.
Yeah, which must have driven you nuts trying to put that together.
The staff and the telephone services take care of those things. Yep. But yes, we are an international body. We are an internationally recognized and active body. I guess, what more do I need to say? We are meeting, again, April 6 and 7, I believe, and we had scheduled that, or maybe it's 7 and 8. We'd scheduled that back in December with the hope that we wouldn't have to meet then in person, but we are clearly going to meet then in person, largely to take up the second draft and address the materials in the second draft that weren't in the first draft. So we thought we'd actually skip the second draft, but since second draft has new material, we'll take on that on our April board meeting. And we're especially looking forward to that chapter 4, because it really is the chapter 4 where you integrate how science is going to interact with policy goals as science keeps evolving, as problems keep evolving, as we learn what we can and can't accomplish along the way. So the board is, you know, thinking chapter 4 is really the most important for the long term. For setting up, all the other chapters are important, but for actually carrying it out, it's how much we've committed to in chapter 4 that's going to be crucial.
Have you looked ahead to the month of May, which is the month where we're going to approved for publication and certification, the draft Delta plan, and then we get a little 45-day breathing period. And what I would like to know is, will your schedule allow your reaction prior to that?
Yes, we plan to be looking at draft 3 prior to an early May meeting and be commenting back to you on a schedule similar to the ones we laid out here, where,
right.
Yeah, it'll be the same process on draft 3.
Okay.
Yes.
Ms. Marcus.
Just sort of looking forward to the continuing effort to figure out how to give us exactly the review we need while also helping point us in the right direction. I know we talked about that last time, and it's hard to do when you're gathering so many scientists, but my hope is that you're thinking about how you can, through this process, give us some useful pointers and some direction versus telling us all the things you can't come to conclusion on, because that could be frustrating over time.
I think, you know, we're definitely planning to sort of say, here's the quality of the science, and you still have to decide whether it's good enough, but, you know, we're very aware that there are going to be good enough issues. I think Joe is also hoping, and certainly to the extent we can, we will be suggesting, you know, additional documentation, additional evidence, But as a science board, we also have to make sure that the basis of the findings isn't stacked with material that supports going a particular direction if there's other material that contradicts sort of what's here.
Well, no, I actually appreciate that. If it contradicts, that's going to be helpful. But I think there are a lot of findings we're going to have to make that aren't scientifically based, or we're going to have to move forward on certain things without having this level of findings. It's just my view. Fully, this isn't a science report. It's a public policy report where you integrate science, but that's not the only factor. So I want to figure out how to do that in a way that's comfortable is not the right word, but appropriate to the task, because this isn't just a science exercise.
We fully understand it, but we are the science arm of the
science. I totally understand that.
Science policy exercise.
No, I totally understand that. This is sort of akin to the comments I had for our Arcadis colleagues, where early on, where just a list of what hasn't been done leaves you nowhere and leaves an impression there's something wrong.
No.
So you need to find a way to talk about the distinction, sort of like my smoking metaphor, of where the paths are possible, and give us advice without leaving it with a, if it's not science, it stinks. So tone is going to be important.
If it's not science, it stinks?
Well, I have great faith in Dr. Norgaard, but I just think it's something you have to work at, and the translation between scientists, public policy, engineers, public policy, et cetera, is at the heart of this kind of work. I love it, actually. But it takes some conscious thought about how to bridge and see, the overall public policy picture versus just a slice of it. So the extent you can, I know it can be uncomfortable, can figure out how to put yourself in our shoes in a bigger setting, that the easier that translation will be.
I'm, among the science board members, maybe more comfortable with that process than, because I am a social scientist myself and have been involved in the process. Certainly there's, you look at Chapter 9, there's a lot of material on governance, there's a lot of findings that, our legislative declarations, just how we're going to address that or not address those as a board, we'll have to decide. And but we're certainly appreciative and aware of the exercise we're in.
Okay, Ms. Gloria.
Thank you. I had a question regarding why you were not addressing the second draft, but you've indicated that you will include that second draft in your review. But can you clarify again how your report will integrate, or how the council will be aware of what your board's review of the Delta Plan will be?
Because the Delta Plan is coming out sequentially.
Right.
We have to operate sequentially. There will be, and because of the reporting and public notice complications, how we integrate definitely has to lag.
Will it be written information to that Joe will present to the council? I guess that's what I'm getting to, the process.
I think when we, every board decision or every board report, every board memo will come back to the council through me, but it'll also be posted as a board.
Public information, right.
As public information. It's required to.
So, for example, Dick mentioned that they were going to do a draft report by March the 10th, I think.
Yes.
And we are going to take that and use the information from that for our next draft of the Delta Plan. They won't have their final report done probably until we're complete with that next draft. But that's okay, because we'll have another chance when they do their next update.
It's very much like receiving all the public comments that come in.
Except that the independent science board's a level above the public comments.
Oh, I know. And it's a statutory recognition.
And it is.
And as a board, there may be material that we do not want to post by March 10th, because just like your draft plan one is not fully complete, we may not be comfortable without another face-to-face meeting saying some of the things that we are discussing. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Let's see, since we have the two top scientists in this operation sitting here and our lawyer sitting here and Mr. Grindstaff sitting here, I thought I'd just raise the question that there is a 4-month settlement in the smelt litigation
that was announced in the newspaper after we recessed last night. I've read a couple of articles. What does it mean?
I haven't read those articles. I'm going.
Yeah, I've.
Nor have I.
Dr. Dom, it's up to you. Okay,
I Randy. Stayed at the Holiday Inn last night.
No, it means that peace has broken out temporarily.
Yes. Yeah. Yep.
For 4 months.
For 4 months. Yeah, it is some kind of stipulation. We'll all read it. Maybe Chris, you could kind of assume the obligation of sending
absolutely.
Out and posting on the web a short summary in your view of that. That would be appreciated. Okay, Doctor. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. All right, members. Let's go back to file item number 7, the draft Delta plan. My recollection is we'd paused before Chapter 6, but Ms. Marcus had a couple of questions on Chapter 5 she wanted to go back to.
Yeah.
Let's let our team come up here first. All right. Let's wrap up on questions on Chapter 5, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, well, actually, I have a sort of a procedural thought on it. As I said, I have a whole boatload of comments and questions on some of these findings and edits. I'm not sure that's the best use of time today. So I want to just get totally clear on what the process will be right. So I don't miss a shot.
Okay.
You know, at being able to do it. I found it really helpful to listen to the comments yesterday to get the submissions. I think it gives us a lot to think about, not just on editing it this way, but on how to do the whole thing. So I want to have a chance to talk about that at some point. Doesn't have to be now, but I just want to signpost that I don't think it's that useful for, at some point it will be, but for all 7 of us to say this word, that word, here's what I want, here's what I don't in this process, unless that's how you want to do it. So I have preliminary thoughts, but I don't have thoughts.
Here's what I'd like to suggest to us is that we kind of tentatively in our mind agree that for an hour, maybe 90 minutes, we review the rest of the draft Delta plan ourselves publicly and then call for comments from the audience. Of course, we received a bunch yesterday. Now, I think 90 minutes max ought to do that, but I'm not positive, but I'd like to aim for that, then get public comments, then catch up with any responses to the public comments that we have.
But that won't be. I can't give you my definitive comments sitting here today.
How about, okay. How
I just need a little time to digest what everybody said.
Okay.
To relook at it.
I think
there are findings that are missing that ought to be in there. There are things I don't get why they're there or not.
Well, the other possibility, of course, is maybe just for members, we can also record by email comments, questions posted on the web, because we're required to do that in lieu. I don't know what's the right, or we wait till the next meeting, because, you know, the next meeting is the first part of March 9th? In 2 weeks. There is a meeting in 2 weeks. We could flag some time for follow-up comments then, too.
I just however you want to do it. I'm just trying to help, and I can't be as helpful today. I could be sort of helpful, but I can't be as helpful as I'd like to be. And if each of us goes through every word thing, we're going to be here for... I'm just trying to figure out the best use of our time without shutting down my ability to give you input into how I think it ought to go.
And I think our intent is on the 10th and 11th to spend much more time on each of these areas in even more depth.
Yeah, and unfortunately I can't be here the 10th because I have my own organizational board meeting. I'll
right.
be here the 11th. But the,
okay,
the
so either, and I agree with you. I mean, the findings, I don't agree with how the findings are all worded. I would probably change some of them if it were my decision. So my assumption is that this really is a first draft that will be improved as the science board makes recommendations and as we move things through the process. I think maybe we just need to keep going through the process and after you've spent some time reading through it and thinking about it, maybe we should talk about how is the best way
to
make sure
I want to read everything, all the comments that came in, and think about the best of it. And
I agree.
We talked about it a little bit yesterday, but I'm just not convinced this is layering of doing the findings first, then only doing policies when we've decided that seriatim thing. That's not going to work in terms of us really doing a good process. I think we spent maybe too much in time on what the thing will look like yesterday. I don't think that's the best use of our time here, as some of the speakers said. But I do think it's worth spending some time to think about how it all fits together. And for me, I kind of need to see findings and policies together, and then you're doing a puzzle to see how it fits. You know, one of the things I'd suggest is where there's not a, you know, you have a finding that you put into a certain chapter or a certain level, but it actually, I'll take water conservation, all that, it has its own, those tools have their own little tag, but they're integral and smart to tie in with water supply reliability in that section. So you need a cross-reference at least, or maybe you put them in multiple places where they fit. I don't know. I want the staff to kind of figure that out.
Yeah, and I think we've decided against the multiple places because it gets so confusing. We tried it.
Then you need a cross-reference.
Oh, yeah.
Because otherwise, I'm just telling you, as a regular person, you read it through, and it's like, you get distracted. I mean, I think, as someone said yesterday, we can think about how to organize it better at the end as opposed to worrying about it now, but I'm just telling you how it works better for me, because some of this is in the abstract. It's sort of like when you're doing planning and everybody has to do goals, objectives, strategies, and you spend an enormous amount of energy trying to torque things to fit a grid, which, again, is a certain personality type. I find it more helpful to have the narrative and figure out what the heck are we trying to do in the objective and where are our choices, and to talk about those choices versus editing words.
Okay.
So I'm not sure how to get to that, and I'd love to be a part of thinking about how to get there, but I'm a little worried we're going to be doing like a math exercise of layers. These guys are going to be doing massive writing and rewriting, when if we can get to what the hard questions are early and tee up those issues, it'll be easier to write afterwards. I'm just worried we're going into that block by block process that I feared at the beginning. And I know there's no perfect way to do it, and maybe we try it this way and I can go with it, but I'm just worried we're not going to get to that heart of doing something that's really additive and useful, that builds on the Delta Vision report and ends up giving something that's very useful, both in terms of thou shalts and, you know, the legislature or someone else should list of recommendations, which, you know, we want to knock it out of the park on that.
I expect all of that stuff to be in the next draft.
Okay.
I actually agree with almost all of your comments.
Terry?
Yeah, at the March 10th and 11th workshop, it is our intent to go into those kind of issues on each of these four chapters that were in this first draft, to really drill into the issues and the hard questions. And that's intended to be a facilitated discussion in each of the sessions.
Don and then Randy.
Okay. Well, I guess I wanted to go back to, because the areas that they're really beyond the text that caught my attention, obviously, was in the working categories of, it's obvious, but obviously to me, working categories of potential policies and recommendations. And you've got these bullets of different things that are touched upon, I guess, in the text earlier in the chapters. But if I went to just on chapter 5, for example, and you've got this list on page 5-7, and I just picking out a couple, because some of them, things we've kind of talked about, at least in with some of our questions. But for example, when you on lines 13 through 20, I'm trying to get some sense about what in what format then you would bring forward either policies or recommendations. Here you have this integrated regional water management plans. Then you got bullets, sub bullets below that: efficiency, recycled water, use of currently non-potable groundwater. If you just take a moment to tell me then how you would look at framing that, are you going to have additional text that would talk to those items and then come in with discussions about either policy recommendations or statements? I mean, I'm trying to get some sense of how then that ties back, because, again, you pulled things together here that have a general reference to some of these things. But
again, this goes to the March 10th and 11th.
Okay, I heard you on that
workshop, and our intent is to go through, drill down in the findings, discuss the findings more, and then also get to these potential strategies and policies, and be able to discuss them and get a sense of the direction that you want to go. And at the point we know what we want to do with these, then we can start deciding whether they fall into a policy or a recommendation. And then we will use that input to build the second draft, the complete second draft.
Okay. Well, Terry, just going off that for a second then, if we just bump down, so take line 21, future water supply contracts. For an example, what sort of discussion, again, not to as a precursor, but what sort of discussion would you bring forward on future water supply contracts?
I think Joe's going to field
that. I'll be glad to answer that. Remember, in the end, the Delta Plan becomes regulation. So what we're talking about doing is developing the strategies or policies that become regulations that apply to different people who have covered actions. So my expectation, and I know the contractors hate this, but I don't see any way around it. I'll say it publicly. My expectations are that new contracts for exported water are covered actions. And as covered actions, they need to be consistent with the Delta Plan. And what you put into the Delta Plan in terms of integrated regional water management standards or water use efficiency standards are things that they need to be consistent with. So, and you're right, when we get to that discussion, it will be intense because suddenly everybody's going to realize, oh, these rules are going to be applied to me. And that's difficult, but that's what we're talking about here. So this list of issues here are the real heart of the policies that we're talking about, and that will be very controversial. That will really, or maybe not as controversial as I think, but it will really set the standards that everybody has to live up to as we move ahead.
Joe, just asking that. So then that would be similarly, so if you're looking at future water transfer, statewide storage, and Delta diversions, the consideration would be whether or not we would boil this down to a potentially covered action and then tie that back into the Delta Plan. So on all these things, we're going to, to a lesser or more degree, going to have conversation about how they might be enforceable, because we talked yesterday about suggestions and, recommendations that may not be in the same category as regulations that are enforced.
Yes, and there will be, and one of the things we want to do when we bring these things to the council is bring them in different formats so that you can look at it and say, well, maybe we shouldn't have a regulation on this. Maybe we should just have a recommendation here. Maybe we should have a regulation on this, and maybe it should be worded this way or it should be worded that way. And so my hope is that we have a fact sheet, if you will, on each of these potential regulatory areas, and that we can actually talk about each one of them. Now, we're probably not going to want to try and define in every case exactly what a covered action is and what it's not, because the law already does that. And who knows what's out there that we don't know about. But at least we can talk about the things that we do know and set those standards. So that's what this list was about. And honestly, they gave us a list of potential regulations, which I didn't think was what we needed to bring to the council because it wasn't ready yet. There were things in there that I thought needed to be worked through more before we actually published it as something. So but what we did is actually go through their document and say, here are the different areas where they propose that we do something of a regulatory nature. So we will be coming back to you and we'll have explicit discussions about each one of these areas.
Well, thank you for that explanation. That helps me then as I'm kind of thought process here, because I saw these being very key And now I understand, and again, if we're going to have that conversation in going
forward. We are going to have that conversation. I suspect you'll have more than enough of that conversation before we're done.
Yeah, there's plenty in each chapter. Okay, thanks.
Okay, Randy, Hank, and then Felicia. No, Randy and then Hank.
Gwen, yesterday you asked for input from the council. And we all said a lot of things yesterday, but I left here frustrated that, at least personally, I didn't feel like I was very helpful to you as a council member, telling you what I would like to see, what I think is important, in the big general policy level kinds of directives. So I have 5 points that I came up with last night that I think, well, it's an effort to try and summarize what we all talked about last night, and it's an effort to try and reach a conclusion this morning that this is what the council thinks, more or less, to help guide you as you're developing the second draft. Because I've got lots of notes, too, on the first, but I recognize we're still talking about what's important and what's not, and not the details. So the first conclusion I reached yesterday is that we want to simplify the findings. Phil identified that the first 3 chapters could be consolidated into something altogether much shorter. The fact sheets are helpful. We need to verify the facts that are included in the findings, but we do need to consolidate that into a lesser amount of verbiage. I believe that we concluded yesterday that the findings come first, which lead to the policies, which then lead to the recommendations or regulations. And it's the policies that this body needs to focus on. The third item is that this is a regulatory plan. And there was a lot of comments yesterday about the need to make it like a story. To the degree possible, that should be done, but it needs to remain evident to everyone that this is a regulatory plan. Number 4, we talked about the format and how things should be included or where they should be included. I think we need to leave that up to you. And the second draft, you may learn things from that that you want to substantially change and incorporate into the third draft. But by the time we get to the third draft, I think we should have the chapters complete, and we should have pretty much the set format. Because the next iteration is the one that we go public with. So I think that was something that we all... We tried to help you yesterday with telling you how to number pages and things like that, but I think you'll do fine on your own with that. And then the final one, in terms of policy issues, there are things that we're not going to have enough information, or the information that we're depending upon from others will not be complete. We need to recognize that, and we need to identify that in the plan as items that we need more information, or we'll have to delay action until a further date when that information is complete. The San Francisco Bay Plan, I think, serves as a good model for how to do that. So that's my effort to try and bring some focus to the remaining task today as we look at the plan.
Hank? And then Felicia.
I've never been accused of being a process guy, but I'm going to try to take what Randy has done and give you little recommendations about process. And I'm reminded of what President Reagan said. When the government shows up at your door and says, we're here to help, run like hell. So take that with a little voice of criticism. I think ultimately, and I've been doing this sort of thing for a long time, when you know what you want to do, the easiest format, and I used to, 35 years ago, be head of strategic planning for Pfizer, and we'd come up with a strategic plan with actions. And a guy who had been around a lot longer than I had at the time said the easiest format is a what, why, and how. What are you going to do? why are you going to do it, and how are you going to get it done? And it reads well, and before each chapter you can say that, you know, in probably a full paragraph. What are you going to do? This is our policy recommendation. Why is it going to be done? Just the essence of it, and then how we're going to do it, and the money's involved. And then the details will come after that. The alternatives considered, why some were accepted, others were rejected, and all the rest of that. So I think that should be the final format. But it doesn't really work as a work in process because we really don't know our recommendations yet. And in order to collect that, maybe a way to proceed would be to put down the problem and state that in a macro sense. And then look at alternatives for solving that problem. And then that should lead you to your recommendation. So it's a process that you can work through. And I hate to get hung up on format, but if we do agree on a format with certain buckets to use, it sort of facilitates it. And again, I would suggest doing it in outline form, just the bullets, no prose. Put the prose in later, but just try to get the essence, the essential facts down there and discuss them. Because we don't want to get hung up in wordsmithing at this point. I mean, that's at the very end of it.
Felicia, then Gloria.
That's very helpful to me because I wanted to disagree respectfully with Randy's summary on some point because I think I do like the San Francisco Bay Plan as, to me, that's a summary of what they did. It's not the, I think our plan's going to have exactly what Hank said, and I want an ability to have that thought process and go through a strategic process, which will be messy. And there's no way in my mind our plan is anything like a real plan until we go through the EIR process and look at alternatives and let people talk about it. To me, that issue of how you've thought about it and what the options were is really important. And maybe the EIR will have a lot of the stuff in it in parallel that will allow the plan itself to be shorter. But I really like that intro paragraph that makes it intelligible to people who are reading this as opposed to the quick summary. I think I actually believe in the need for that, but I also, you've helped me reconcile the two views because we've got to see it as a useful draft until we get to the point where this baby becomes more real, which is through the alternatives review process, where no matter how strongly held from sitting here, not having spent the next few months with all the great people on the staff and in the audience and in the world who will write in, the thing will become real and we'll make some real choices. So I do agree with Randy. I think about it, that you guys should figure out the format, but I think the way Hank just said it made me feel a lot better than where I felt we were going.
Gloria.
Yeah. My comments are, I think the format is important as it relates to readability, but for me, the most important thing is that the plan is defensible. That the perception is that we have used the best available science to make the best decisions, and it's defensible. So for me, that's the word that just kind of sticks out, that whatever our decisions are in the plan, whatever format we use, that is defensible to anyone out there as we make our decisions based on the fact they will be regulations eventually.
Okay. Mr. Grindstaff, your mic's on. Do you want to add anything to that?
Sorry.
Okay. All right. Well, I don't have to say anything. I participated in a two-year study that produced a strategic plan with 120 specific recommendations or something, so my position is relatively outlined. I would just add one thing. I believe that a lot of the discussion about process and how it all works together and doesn't work together is a reflection of the fact that the choices are very difficult political choices that we face. And my experience in the water world and in most public policy is everybody, legislators and the public, uncomfortable with making tough choices, prefers to talk about process. I think process is a way, and I think this skeleton outline we're doing, we're really, in many ways, talking to ourselves to try to figure out how serious we are about making the tough decisions. And the staff's going to have to focus. Hank, I predict from this meeting. The staff will, with none of us in the room, will have this conversation. They have it about me, and they'll have it about, so they'll say, God, he said market pricing. What are we going to do with that? They're going to say that. And then the argument is, well, yeah, but he said there's a lot of underground water, so we don't have to worry about it. What does that mean? And how you bring those comments together and how you present to us, whether it's groundwater or conservation or facilities or anything at all in the scope of our duties, is really difficult, because the staff would prefer to have a clear expression of policy preference from all of us in all major particularities as fast as they could get it. And of course, we are not capable of doing that. But I suspect that we will all find ourselves uncomfortable as this discussion goes forward. But I think it's primarily the uncomfortable nature of looking at a complicated situation, trying to figure out what the major elements are, and then understanding that no matter what we say or don't say or how we say it, all of our friends in the audience will stand up and say, you're wrong, you can't do it that way, it's terrible. That's what I think will happen. That's my experience of 50 years in public policy. Interest groups basically always say that. How you plow through that is what we're trying to figure out. So, I mean, I'm comfortable in general with Randy's approach. I don't disagree with either of your approaches.
I think they're pretty close.
Yeah.
I mean, what we're trying to do is get a process for organizing so we don't get hung up on it and start talking format all the time. But I think it really is important that at the end of the day, we have our recommendations prioritized. Mm-hmm. 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. So that if we have enough money, you know, X dollars, we can do 1 and 2, and that would be the recommendation.
Yeah. I think the most important, one of the most important things you had said is that we really haven't focused on the financial stuff. And I don't mean the plans and what we recommend, but maybe as PPIC did, the difficulty in the current political environment with the restraints on federal and state spending and local spending and public attitudes. We haven't focused on what the hell does that mean for what is essentially a vast public policy infrastructure program. I mean, that's very complicated.
Well, essentially what that means is you have to be defensive first. In other words, you have to protect what you have.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't be at all surprised if, restoring the levees and preventing flood damage and earthquake damage wouldn't be number one into those times of very constrained funding.
Yeah. Felicia.
Another issue that came to the fore yesterday in a number of people's comments I thought was a good one, which was not to wait to figure out not just even the funding, but what are the cost-effective aspects of these things. I mean, comparing costs of certain options versus the other, the cost benefit becomes very important. And the idea that we should be looking at that for each of those as they go along will facilitate us making certain choices and all that. And also teeing up the really hard choices early, I am all for that.
Well, I am too, although I'm conscious that the hard choices will make each of us nervous in different ways. I mean, Don sits there and he represents, as an elected official, an area that doesn't like facilities that to take water anywhere else, but likes to have money for levee improvements, and they want to have local control of land use decisions. Okay. I mean, that presents a whole series of things. All of this does. And, you know, if we just stick with it, if the staff actually tolerates our imprecision a bit longer and presents us, as Joe says, with options and alternatives, it starts to focus, I think that will be helpful. And hopefully at the end of this process, we surprise ourselves a bit on what we're willing to say or do. Even me. Okay.
I'll bring Don his coffee.
Okay. All right. That's kind of gone through the larger introductory comments. Terry, Gwen, what do you need for the rest of you've had really no staff reaction to a couple of chapters. I mean, no council reaction to a couple of chapters. Would it be useful to you to try to get at least general comments?
That would be helpful, because I'm not as worried about the wordsmithing and because as I said yesterday, I'm not anticipating that the second draft, second staff draft is going to be it will be very different in many ways, consolidated, less wordy. And in many other cases, it may be more wordy, a lot more tables and bullet points, et cetera, as we bring in the policies. But I think we went a long way yesterday in the Chapter 5 for the water resources and the discussions about the focus of the approach. I think as we go through the last three chapters that we've presented in the first staff draft, the ecosystem restoration, the reduce risk, and the Delta as an evolving place. I'd be interested if something basically just either was apparent that it was either too much of a focus, too little of a focus, missing, needs to be higher priorities. I would just be interested right now on getting that information. I felt yesterday's discussion, even though we had some other ones, discussions too, were good about format, but I did... I made quite a few pages here of detailed notes of everybody's discussion, and it will be useful in the next go-around.
Felicia?
Then I'll just give her some high points on five before we move to six.
Okay.
I have more, but let me just give you a few that I just thought was really important. I thought the discussion about whether the water supply was finite or not, and I'm in the camp that says if we manage it better, it'll go a lot longer. So I didn't like the way that was just a definitive statement, and that's why I like the integration of the tools you can use. I think when you look at cost effectiveness, you're going to see the water use efficiency, recycling, and all those things pack a lot of bang for the buck and extend our reach. The other issue in reliability that's in there is if you look at the bullet about surface and groundwater supplies will only be reliable on a long-term basis if groundwater overdraft is eliminated. I think that's one thing you could say. I think the more useful thing to say is we need to manage surface water and groundwater together. And we need to operate the whole system. There's a whole issue of how you can operate all the different storage facilities we already have, how you can facilitate groundwater banking, which you can't do unless you know what's there. There's a whole host of things that were talked about even in the CalFed days. People experimented with. There were some failures that were failures of psychology and metrics and not having monitoring. But that's where I double down. Those are the obvious things, as opposed to jumping to that statement. I think that's a really important to think through. I agree a little bit later in the issue someone raised about, I think it was Phil, about urban water residential use has not declined. I mean, going back to 65 and saying it hasn't declined, that's like an inflammatory statement which jumps out at everybody else, like me, and anyone in Southern California who knows the heroic things that have actually been happening down there that should be exported to other places. So that's why I like those boxes and stories, but it just missed the mark. The issue is we've been able to do it successfully, and we need to do more, and it's cost-effective to do more, and as opposed to, you know, that's not a useful finding to me. So that kind of thinking about it. Similarly, I appreciated the chairman's getting of what the period is, this last one about that they're vital for a lot of, you know, things. And then the seawater desalting being sort of in there that made it seem like everything else wouldn't happen for decades. That was just confusing. And I like the prioritizing the brackish water desalination. I think there's a lot there. And then just putting desalinization in its place. Otherwise, those are policies as opposed to necessarily findings. So just reworking that, I thought it was really pretty clunky. Most of my other comments I can give you guys later, but those were the big ones that just jumped out at me that I went, wow, with all the talking we've done, all the things going on, I was surprised. Now, I know a lot ended up on the cutting room floor and you guys were working your butts off. So as I said yesterday, I think a lot of this is really well written and I tend to like words more. I like the explanatory stuff. Personally, as I said before, but those are ones that would really have to change because they were like, as I said, they're like the splinters on the wood when you're trying to read. All of a sudden, it just was like, whoa, why is that there? So those are my thoughts on five at the higher level.
Okay. Anyone else have anything to add on chapter five? Okay. Let's go to chapter six, the ecosystem section. Can I just give you a general comment? I've always thought the ecosystem was more elaborately developed because the statute gave us more guidelines, hints, directions, and mandates on ecosystem than they did any of the other things. And also because I thought your white paper, Gwen, was the fullest developed of all of them.
just a gut instinct. The real question on ecosystem for me is whether the consultants, the staff, together with the science team, can in some sense give us an intelligent prioritization and phasing schedule for what an ecosystem is. The policy question that's fundamental, it seems to me, is must the ecosystem changes, recommendations, whatever they are, proceed, which is a question of are they funded as a condition of everything else going ahead, or are they simply a hope to be achieved activity while all the other things, including facilities, proceeds on its own? Are they linked or are they not? I personally feel that they have to be linked, both for legal reasons but also for policy reasons, but that's just one view. And then I'm interested, as Felicia has indicated, in what you come up with on some of the itemizations. I think I'm agnostic on the staging of what it is, but I think we need some specificity on an ecosystem. I'd like to be able to say the Delta Plan has come as close as any document has to defining a desired ecosystem we are attempting to achieve in some ways over the next 90 years, as opposed to simply being a laundry list of everybody's favorite ideas that fall under the nomenclature ecosystem. So that's all for me. Don.
I guess a general comment would be that, and it's in one of the yet-to-be published or developed sections, is that I think that there are significant linkages, as there may be throughout this document, on other items, but mm-hmm. with Chapter 6 and Chapter 10, I think that the restoration of the Delta ecosystem, the governance, is going to be a very key and critical piece, and from a number of perspectives, certainly in the act that created this council and redefined the role of the Protection Commission. I think the Delta Conservancy needs to be looked at in a very thorough way, both in the EIR vetting, but also in this particular chapter as to the Conservancy's role, because there's a discussion in a couple of the bulleted points here about, well, there's not really a mechanism or a body that can do this, and I know BDCP had some proposals in it about how that was going to be handled and so forth, and yet the law in creating the Delta Conservancy, I think, certainly gave some definition around the role of that conservancy, and I think it's important when it comes to governance because of the representation there. You have both state agencies and certainly interested parties, but this is where I think from the standpoint of local communities and counties, on-the-ground restoration, when you start talking about, excuse me, in some of the categories on page 6-7 that you're still going to come back with discussion on, but when you get into development of land acquisition protocol, acquiring land for protection and restoration, that needs, at the very basic level, in my view anyway, and certainly I'm speaking on behalf, I think, of the commission, it needs to be a very integrated and coordinated approach, and not, I think what we have right now is you have any number of agencies and entities that go about both restoration and to satisfy project requirements, but also with their own initiatives for different purposes. And I think this in this chapter, when you talk about the integration of those roles, and hopefully come out with some you know policy recommendations. Again, whether they're going to that category of you know, enforceable or regulations, I don't know. But I just think very strongly when you start talking about those areas from the local perspective where you're looking at, creating and or restoring habitat, the local impacts, the economic impacts, obviously, and some of that goes to the sustainability plan. And Gwen, you folks mentioned that as being a component that may help guide some of the discussion here. But the agricultural concerns, specific procedures, and we'll see more of that. But I guess my comment just for today's purposes is that I think I see ties to governance, but certainly to definition of and respect for roles of agencies that are, given that authorities by the state, but also your counties and local communities. To me, that's a key piece, and I think it's a key piece potentially, as we come out with recommendations, to any successes that may occur long term. And it ties back, as I said, to a number of things that certainly the economic impacts, but really respecting the rights not only of landowners, but certainly of communities and those impacts, and looking at trying to get to an ecosystem restoration and meet that one of the co-equal goals in that respect. So, again, general comments, but I think I see this being key, and when Chapter 10 comes forward, how you pull those two together will be important, at least in my view. Thanks.
Okay, who wants to weigh in on an ecosystem? Felicia, then Randy? Felicia.
Sorry. Just a few things to toss in. Again, the top line things that I saw. The bullet on the Delta ecosystem is irreversibly changed is probably an understated fact. You can find a lot on there's a great line in the PPIC report that it operates more like a confused lake than the estuary it once was. I kind of like that one. So, again, it points to the system, and this was one of the things I did like in the PPIC book, though I didn't love their title for it, of, you know, our job is to figure out what we can do within reason versus trying to restore it to its pristine state, bring back Tulare Lake. I mean, we can't do those things. So the issue is what's reasonable. And I look forward to sort of the policies, but I thought that, I think, you know, I mean, you'll probably get a lot of comments on how to say that in a different way so that people don't take it as it's irreversibly changed, so let's throw up our hands and go away. So I would prefer something that says it's irreversibly changed from its pristine state, but there's something we can do. You know, and you're going to find that a lot in my comments in terms of things you say that you may not understand the consequences of, and to which I would say important and true, but not useful, and it's with a period there on some of those comments because it can lead people to conclusions that aren't going to be helpful or realistic. The next one I really I loved, this that you put in this issue of the processes for obtaining project-specific permitting are not well coordinated. That's like the understatement of the year. I think we will be seen as heroes if we can point out the places where there should be more coordination, and they are legion on almost anything we do here. And I would say that's the top, I'm hoping that'll be the top priority when within this administration, of rationalizing some of these things. Because in many cases, for permittees or for anybody in the system, part of what frustrates people is the lack of coordination, how crazy it is, how there's duplicating, there are conflicts and all of that. That's almost more important than the substance of what we're asking people to do. So to the extent we can do that, and whether it's, I don't know how you regulate it, is really strong recommendations, I would love that as a theme everywhere it comes out, because maybe even through the force of our recommendation, it'll get more attention in general on that one. So I'm hoping it leads to lots of really cool policy decisions and options. I would encourage you to talk to the folks at Sustainable Conservation. Ashley Boren is the executive director. I used to be on their board. They have spent years working in exactly this space to try to make the interface between, in particular, ag, but also industrial users who are trying to do good stuff, speed through a process. And they have all the same frustrations that any stakeholder you can think of have, but they've been thinking about this for years. So I would just encourage you to meet with them, and I'm happy to facilitate that. This bullet that some people know really irritated me was that even with substantial restoration efforts, some native species may not survive, period. My response to that in my notes was, duh. Not, oh no, but it was, yeah, of course, that happens all the time. But that statement standing alone sounds like we're saying, so why bother? Let's pick your favorite species that's annoying and let's triage it. I wasn't happy with PPIC either, but at least in PPIC they had a teeny little footnote that explained you wouldn't go there first. I mean, there are all kinds of listed species. They get listed because a government agency actually is looking at them and listing them. Sometimes there's a petition. But there's zillions of other threatened and endangered species that nobody's looking at or listing that, in the de facto course of what happens, we can't keep them all. It's a good goal. We can't keep them all. I think the issue for us is to be a little more sophisticated in how we state this finding, which is, you know, some of them won't. Yeah, right, obvious. But what is it, what can be done, or where, you know, or you could say, but we can prioritize them. I don't know what the answer is, but that standing alone is this red flag and too vague for, you know, or too obvious. But it creates an opening for us not, I mean, it was the headline in the Chronicle, of course, and it sort of leads, it gives a misleading view of what it is we're trying to do under the co-equal goal. So something a little more reasonable about what the complementary goal I think would be. I think words pack a punch, and I think it's important to think about those. Then on the issue of reduced threats and stresses, I just thought there's some layer of things where I didn't understand why you had more findings than others. And I must say, on my list of things, I would love to see the list of findings that ended up on the cutting room floor because you couldn't find a citation for them. And let's look through them because maybe we can help you find some citations because there's just stuff missing. And I'm thinking maybe that's where it comes from. And that's similar to my conversation with Dr. Norgaard. I just think if we... It's not all science. So I would just like to know what you didn't put in that you thought about putting in because you didn't have support. Because there are some things missing. This issue of introduction of toxic plant animal species have degraded, that's one aspect of that. But another aspect of that, again, that was in the PPIC report, which I thought was really important and interesting thought, is that the change conditions in the Delta, because of the nature of the flow regimes and other stressors, create conditions that are conducive to these invasive species being able to overcompete with the native species. And to a certain extent, if you change those conditions, the native species have a fighting chance against the invasive species. So a more sophisticated look at that would, as a finding, would acknowledge that fact. And it gives us something really interesting to think about that also, again, moves and advances the conversation in this tough dialogue. And it suggests policies where you may want to, and this gets to my next point, where you may want to think about what are some of the solutions we may have that are not the 800-pound gorilla solutions at a simplistic level, like the simplistic conversation people have been having about the state board's flow finding, which, or whatever we're going to call it, flow thing, which was meant to be a bookend, not
flow thing. I like that.
I don't know what to. I'm sorry. I'm trying to like finish because I'm using too many words here. I'm using up my word count for the day. Where it's a more sophisticated thing of you're not going to. There's no way we're going to restore things as they were pre-industrialization or pre-gold rush or any of that. But there's stuff we can do that's not just that overall number about flow for the whole delta. It's we can create places in the delta where you can create enough habitat that you're going to get some species back without saying everybody goes there. That's a more sophisticated, targeted policy approach that we should be getting to eventually. So I would just like to see something about, I don't know if you call them microflows in special places, or something about the fact that, you know, changing those conditions in some places, or I think as PPIC said, at the margins of some riverbanks, you know, can pack a lot of impact that'll help us. So as we're thinking about how to restore, it's not all the big, epic battles that are the quality of the conversation out there. It's us getting down into the specifics, which maybe feeds into something else as an overall that I think we should think about that I heard yesterday that really stuck with me last night, which is there are so many regional differences. So if we say there's huge groundwater overdraft, there's some places where they're managing groundwater really, really well. And we should look at what they're doing, and we should call out the places where it stinks. I mean, if we could do something, maybe it's an appendix, because so it doesn't get long, but if we can just even lay out where there are tons of places where fish restoration and habitat is doing really well, and there are examples all over the place. You learn from those, and you show what can be done. Doesn't mean everybody everywhere has to do that, but if more people did it in more places, the whole thing would be better. So if you can integrate that kind of, then we're taking it to the next level.
Randy.
I would recommend adding one more item under potential policies and recommendations to deal with illegal, potentially illegal diversions in the Delta.
Right, good.
How about potentially illegal diversions in the Delta watershed as well? And the other reason I mention that is we've drawn our planning boundaries, and I know how controversial all of this stuff is, but... What about a possible range of that?
That's fine. I'm not aware of any investigations currently directed outside the Delta, but that's
fine. Nor am I, and that's because everybody
you know, I'm in favor of the investigations in the Delta, but the reality is that happened because the rest of the state ganged up on them because they were momentarily mad in the legislature. And I think it's a good thing it's happening, but I think the rules ought to be equitably applied on unreasonable use of water under current law everywhere in California. It's not just your favorite target. And so I'm not sure where that goes, Gwen, but just as a subject. Oh, Hank, I'm sorry.
Gwen, I had a comment on the same bullet that Felicia mentioned on 6-4, line 25. Even with substantial restoration efforts, some native species may not survive. As someone who deals in probabilities and makes decisions based on probabilities, that sounds like the probability is more than 50% then they will survive. Is that true? Or would a more accurate way of stating it, some native species will probably not survive? Where's the probability?
I think there's still considerable uncertainty about that. I think that what that finding reflects is expert opinion on that subject. I think that based on what people know at this point, that there is a fairly dismal prospect for some of these species, but I think there still is sufficient uncertainty that don't know exactly where that is.
But if you phrase it that some native species will probably not survive, is that more accurate than the way it is here?
I think you're right.
Okay.
Just an observation on that. This is an illustration of a kind of finding that gives rise to what I call the classic political responses. You can't say that. It'll undermine our negotiating position. And that response cuts across all the interest groups in California on all sides of all of the issues. And I think one of the measures of a successful report is being willing to say, if you can document it, things that everybody says privately but doesn't want to said publicly about their interest. And I think the honesty of a report, the Delta plan, is going to be one of its strengths. If we do it right.
Yeah, I think the scientific group has to be apolitical. Let the other people worry about the policy and the political impacts of it. But you put down, you know, call it the way you see them.
Okay. Anything else, Hank? Okay. Anything else on Chapter 6? Okay, these are skimming findings. I'm going to try to get to public comments no later than 11:30 if we can. Let's go to number 7, just to note that that is pending, and it will be the water quality draft will be out, Joe, in the next version. Is that correct?
Yes, it will be out. My hope is actually to release that chapter before the next draft is done, so our hope was the end of next week.
By the way, we ought to highlight that fact. If the consultants and the staff are able to crank out a version of the of any of the chapters that have not been submitted in this first draft, they may post that publicly before the 10 days prior to the next to the end of March meeting, in order to let people have a longer period to look at it, including us. And I hope
in this chapter, especially given that the findings are things that we want our independent science board to evaluate and help us look at closely, we need to get that chapter out. So my hope is that by the 10th, when we have our next meeting, we will have released that chapter. Not that it will be a matter for discussion at that meeting, but just we're going to try and get, as soon as we can, we want to try and get things out publicly for comment.
Okay. All right. Then Chapter 8, which is reduced risk to people, property, state interest in the Delta. Chapter 8. Who wants to start? Pat?
We've had considerable input with differing opinions on the degree to which Delta Islands are at risk from flooding, the condition of the levees, and the threat of earthquakes, I do think that the initial finding is strong and justified by the amount of years it's been in statute. The Delta is flood prone. I think particularly for urban communities and people living in and around the Delta in cities, there's an assumption that all is safe because there hasn't been a flood recently in the locale. And I think policymakers are more easy to respond to the desire to build communities or expand communities within the Delta because in the last decade or the last 100 years there hasn't been a flood. So I think the finding that the Delta is flood prone is an essential anchor to this chapter.
Okay. Randy, do you want to weigh in on that? Don?
Yeah, I would just say this, not unlike the other section, but a very important section, and I appreciated that on the opening to the chapter that right from the get-go on lines 5 and 6, you talk about the economic sustainability plan as being a key component here, and I want to thank the consultants and folks for recognizing that hopefully can help inform as we're looking at emergency preparedness, certainly reducing and managing risk to people and property, but that, again, the balance there, not to compromise safety or people's put people in jeopardy relative to their own personal safety or their community safety, but I might tie that back to, again, some of the working categories on page 6-7, that any number of those items, again, certainly they're you know, fair to discuss and consider, but they need to be also done in the context of I think what it means to existing communities, to you know, conduct of activities that are very compatible with I think some of the other sections that we've heretofore discussed and will discuss in greater detail as the plan continues to see respective drafting in the weeks and months ahead. But again, some of these things are really key because, again, when it comes down to issues of land use, to notification, to setback levies, to all the impacts to making things potentially safer or reducing risk. On the other hand, there is a balance to that, to you know, the vitality and the ongoing activities that underpin, I think, certainly the day-to-day life in the Delta. And again, it is inhabited by people, and again, trying to find that balance is going to be really, really important. So I see a lot of those discussions being very key. I think that recognizing the infrastructure that is there currently and how it serves not only the region and the Delta, but also some of the infrastructure serves the entirety of the state potentially with the power grid, but major populations, obviously with movement of water and other gas and other natural resources. So I guess my comment would be that, again, I think a lot of the devil's going to be in the detail on this, but I do think the focus on certainly emergency preparedness and referencing some of the work that's been done and reducing risk when possible, but also I think one of the comments was made by one or two of the speakers yesterday, how you manage that in the context that you're not going to eliminate risk, and how do you do that in a way that is financially, I think that goes to some of the points we made earlier on some of the other sections, that, you know, what's the financial realities of doing that, and then also looking at some of the other strategies to meet the objectives and certainly try to meet the co-equal goals as well. So, again, I appreciate the work thus far. Obviously, there's a lot of detail to come behind this.
Thanks. Hank?
I think it's really well done. I think this is probably one of the toughest chapters to do. But the only thing I'd like to see in there, and maybe it is, and I didn't see it, is the fact that these are not really levees, that subsidence has turned levees into dikes. And I know a lot of people think, and for me, a levee is something on the banks of a river, so that if the river overflows, then the levee can try to keep the water in a certain channel. But these levees are basically performing like dikes and keeping the water out every day, whether there's a flood or not.
Felicia?
That is a really good point and a finding. That's actually really, really good. I just have one here, which I know you'll be pleased to hear. The only thing in this, I thought these were great. This was sort of the level of number of findings I was sort of wishing we had, and some of the other sections, and I'm impressed with this. The only one that I saw, I won't say missing, and maybe I just missed it because there were so many, was this is a place where I think some cost estimate might actually be helpful. In a way, because I think, you know, at the beginning you talk about strategic levy investments. I think at some point when we get to the policies, we're going to have to do some, I don't know how to do this, so I say this with all humility, some notion of prioritization based on potential threat to human safety and the issue of protecting the water supply. I know it's controversial talking about the salinity intrusion. I just have had a lot of conversations with people about that. But some notion of that should be in the findings, and I think cost is probably the best way, because we want to, that would be a strategic thing to do, because I don't think we can armor them all to the state that it would take. And I'm not saying we should tear them down either, of course not. But I think that's one of the hard things to struggle with. And I find the this is just going to be one of the hardest areas for us. So some sign of a bullet that acknowledges that, however you think best, I think would be helpful in the findings here.
Randy?
It's implied through a number of different potential policy and recommendations, but I don't identify a language that would suggest we need a levy plan
right
in the Delta, which I think we do.
Joe?
Yeah, I just wanted to respond to Ms. Marcus. The question of prioritization of levies, the legislation actually requires that we prioritize levies. Yeah. And one of the questions for us is actually whether we want to do that as part of a finding, which we could do. It's not the typical kind of scientific finding. It would be more a policy finding. We find that these are the highest priority, these are next, and these are next, or if we want to do it some other way. But that is something we do have to address moving forward as we develop this further. And I think the policies will address Mr. Fiorini's issue about planning.
Yeah, I was just thinking of a finding that talks about the cost. So the finding sort of tees off what you do on the policy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not the finding wouldn't be
the prioritization, no. But it would be the one that says this is what
it'd be
it
the
costs
foundational to, finding that talks
okay,
about
what it would cost for
yeah to do them all.
Okay.
Just to think about.
This is still the hardest subject matter for me out of this whole things, but I think the start is closer. This is a chapter that isn't served well by the statutory outline, simply because there's no story you can tell on the whole thing, because the reduced risk to people, property, and state interest in the Delta, which is statutory language, has to have a beginning and end. We're a state agency. The purpose is the co-equal goals, including the recognition of the Delta's unique place and implementation of those goals. But I look at it and I kind of say, well, look, the start on this issue is the state interest, and the state interest is manifold, but, you know, we've got to protect water reliability, we've got to protect the ecosystem, we've got to try to do that in a way that recognizes and preserves the uniqueness of the Delta. And I made the same conclusion. We don't yet have a levy policy. And that's because, of course, America and California have backed into a levy policy because nobody wants to assume full responsibility for everything. And we're trying to deal with 160 years of total governmental confusion. And as a matter of fact, as the PPIC report pointed out, government's involvement actually is much more recent than the state. The state in large
part. It was individual actions and competitive landowners battling with each other about flood control, and the state only grudgingly stepped in and at the last minute, and the feds were dragged kicking and screaming into flood control when the Corps finally was dumped on with the obligation over their bitter objections. And we battled about the armor narrow river streams, you do floodplains, and you know all the fights that have gone on in the history of California are going on today. I'm in favor of a couple of things. I still can't escape the conclusion that the state is backing itself into paterno-like liability for the Delta by being sympathetic to everything and refusing to articulate a state policy of limitations. Don mentioned part of that in his comments. So for me, I think, Joe, we've got to give a crack at a levy policy. But a levy policy can't just be add up what everybody wants and say it ought to be done. That's not a levy policy. And so this floats over into land use, as Don clearly reflects. But if the unique Delta is its rural character, its agriculture, and so on, then you have to marry that with the state interest in some fashion. Now, that may not be a fair and accurate summary of the Delta. I understand there are people who view it differently, but we've got to figure out a way to do it. I like the cost estimates, knowing full well from what's happened for the last 8 months that the minute you come up with a figure, what is the PPIC controversy? You can raise all the levies in the Delta by, is it 3 inches or 6 inches, and it'll only cost you billions and billions? Well, that, you know, we'll argue about that. But the point is, no matter how you couch it, it's a lot of money. But on the other hand, you at least have the thematics that agriculture has been prepared to live with a lower level of flood protection. Sure, they'd prefer to have the highest level of flood protection if somebody else would pay for it, but there's always a matching share, and they are not financially able to come up with vastly. And that's a thing. That's a building block, I think, for this section on levies. It's not without controversy. And the tensions that will come up in the next chapter on land use, particularly with the cities who are expanding their spheres of influence, swallowing up ag land and dumping people into what is mostly, not exclusively, but mostly ag land, they want massive public support for that. So I think there's a lot here. It's dense, it's complex, but it's doable. But I think you need to start laying out some of the stuff that the legislature has told various departments and agencies to do for the last 40 years, which is establish a levy policy, which is a declaration. Guys, we're not going to recover. You know, if sea level rise, we can't recover. Some of the submerged islands can't be protected just because. They must either immediately serve a larger state interest. And not just because the people who own the property say it is in the interest of the state. I mean, I've heard the argument, every island in the Delta is equally important and none of it should be flooded and the state has an obligation to protect all of them. There's no evidence to support that. So I don't know, Joe, you've wrestled with this in your prior life many, many, many times.
Yeah. We will propose policies and alternative policies that you will have to struggle with.
Well, the other thing I wanted to mention to you, the argument that was made yesterday by one of the people that at a minimum you should have levies at a level that qualifies for federal disaster recovery assistance sounds really nifty. But the fact of the matter is federal disaster assistance is going to shrink. It's shrunk in the past. I mean, it's not the deep pocket it once was. And to the extent, and PPIC talks about this too, that is growth inducing, and it arguably is, what's the right policy? I mean, this is very difficult, very, very difficult. And it has bearing, as Don mentions, on many, many, many other areas. So, anyway. Okay, Felicia.
thought. You know, somebody else that might be good to talk to, I know you guys are talking a lot about it, is General Galloway. I think he's a general who wrote the Mississippi study, and he's I can help connect you with him.
He also wrote a 2007 report commissioned by DWR, which was about as forceful as this Mississippi report. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. All right. Anything else on Chapter 8? Anything else? Okay. Let's just Chapter 9, which is the uniqueness of the Delta section. Chapter 9. Who wants a crack at it? Don?
Well, I took that there was going to be quite a bit more to come on this particular section, but I would just note, I think it kind of goes to some of the comments that I made on the previous chapter. And I think that, again, some of the key things in your working categories will help to better, I think, you know, flesh out some of the, you know, the important issues here. But, for example, and again, it goes back to economic sustainability and existing towns and their existence, future existence, say existing towns, or whether they're going to continue to exist and prosper. And that's one of your bullet points to take a look at that. I would just, and again, I part of the conversation here is, and I think it would be useful, I know I've talked with the chair about this, that we're looking at potentially getting a presentation by counties on their general plan approaches to, you know, development, but also how they would permit even, you know, building of a home or other structures. And I do think it might be helpful to this body, Ms. Chair, maybe to have some of the cities come in as well, because, I mean, this is going to be a key issue, and it certainly goes back to local governance and the Delta Protection Commission in doing its land land use and resource management plan wrestled with this, certainly with state agencies, representatives, and doing that plan, but also with, you know, cities and recommendation districts represented at the time we were going through that effort. And it may be useful. I think it may help certainly looking at the aspect of, you know, the uniqueness of the Delta, but also, you know, looking to the future. And as we're going to be considering policy recommendations and potentially regulations that get into the heart of local land use, but also then go back to the key pieces of uniqueness as it relates to the, you know, the various values in the Delta communities, and whether it's agriculture or recreation, certainly environmental and ecological, and then of course the fact that you have people living there in those areas, and are you going to continue to allow people to live there and to work there and to enjoy the Delta? And secondly, in, you know, gets down to numbers and, you know, the future for any growth or potential permitting in the future. And so I think it'll be very important. I know this comes under the area of, you know, again, discussion about covered actions, but I do think that the working categories and some of the things as it relates to, you know, the major gateways and some of the emphasis there, I would compliment our consultants in certainly putting those bullets forward for discussion. And, again, I would just invite, when we do get to really, you know, going through this, Mr. Chair, it might be, again, useful. Again, recognize our time is limited, right, but I think that might be a useful exercise to have both cities and counties to have a conversation about that, because, again, you know, the treatment of this area, secondary and primary zones, and their general plans, and, you know,
Pat, I'm sorry.
I think that's a good idea, and maybe this has already occurred at staff level, but prior to the presentation, sufficiently advanced for the cities and counties to respond, it would be helpful to have some questions for the planning departments who are going to provide the information as opposed to the positions or policies that the elected officials will articulate. I say this because we had the planning departments of the counties at the Delta Protection Commission a couple of years ago, and they had some information, but maybe we didn't ask them enough in advance, or maybe they felt that their objective was to demonstrate that building in the primary zone in particular was de minimis and not much of an issue and not a problem. Well, their staff, they work for other people, so what I'd rather do is just ask the questions. How many homes have been built in the primary zone each year for the last 18 years in by county? And then if the cities are going to testify, at what point did they approve development within the statutory delta? Over what period of time? And perhaps what provision did they make for sufficient flood protection? I live in the city of Stockton, in which new development's been proposed, approved, and built within the city limits or added to the city limits, and is now in danger of flood. That's in the last 20 years. So I'd just be interested in figuring out the factual questions so staff can hopefully produce the numbers, and then we can try and figure out what they mean.
And Ms. Buchholz already has her folks working on spheres of influence for cities and trying to identify how much land is in the sphere of influence area, how it's currently zoned, and because your white paper gave us at least one figure. Since the mid-1980s, about 66,000 acres of ag land had been converted to other purposes. And, we need to have some idea of what's likely out there.
So on the recommendation of, I think it was Hank, but others, that, we figure out the facts and staff does, and then mm-hmm. everybody can argue about the policy, but all the romanticized language about the Delta that we all engage in always seems to me to obscure the reality that if you own a piece of land, a typical way to make some money is to sell it for a big house. And depending on what your right to do that is, a lot of people do it. And they figure out different ways of doing several houses, or just one house, or more. So, is that the evolving Delta place, that there's going to be more of those? And if there are, or if there have been, for instance, and that's the trend, then we ought to at least acknowledge it and come to terms with it. Maybe that will continue, but they'll be at greater flood risk, or maybe that ought not to continue, and then we ought to have a discussion. But that's a policy discussion. I don't want to assume that more has occurred than has, but I do think the economic self-interest, which is understandable of someone who's bought property, paid taxes, perhaps farmed it, and now views the most rational decision, which is to sell it or construct a home or more homes, is a reality we ought to surface.
Don.
Yeah, and I think, and again, Pat and I both, certainly at the Delta Protection Commission level, participated in discussion with the counties. But I think one of the things that, one of the areas cited here, you cite Grand Island, which is in Sacramento County. And it certainly, in Clampetrack, has probably had a dozen or so houses there, right up against an existing established tract that had been there for probably a better part of 40 years. But beyond that, and I think it goes to Pat's reference, that you've had a few carve-outs, 80-acre parcels or 40-acre parcels, where someone's put a home in. In a lot of cases on Grand Island, as you get further into the island, they've had to pad up in order to put those in place. But the reality is that it is consistent with general plans. You have land that can produce because of the fertility of the soil and obviously availability of water and some of the crop patterns there. 80-acre parcel, at least in the Sacramento County general plan, is seen to be a viable parcel, but There certainly has been a handful of houses, but if you were to read this, you would think that there, because it's in the same bullet as substantial urbanization, that on Grand Island you've had urbanization outside of Clampatrack, which is right adjacent to the Walnut Grove Bridge. You really haven't. And in most of the townships, again, I can speak from Sacramento County's experience anyway, you've had minimal, and I think that, you know, the facts will bear themselves out relative to, you know, the communities of Cortland and Hood and some Walnut Grove and some of the other ones on the east side. And as I've pointed out to this body before, but and I say it pretty frequently in other forums, is that between FEMA and between some of the state regulations, you're going to grind things to a complete halt, particularly in the areas where you have more condensed development, i.e. the towns, and we actually have sewer systems that serve them that are publicly operated, in at least the cases of three of the communities, and public water systems in the case of another one, because you can't get the elevations. It'll be so out of context in those communities when you've got, you know, homes that are existing grade that, yes, they may be in an area that's gone to now to a decertified levee, so they're now where they weren't in a floodplain previously, at least by certain standards, they're going to be now. You won't see building there, yet on the islands you may see in some of these larger parcels, because you can have enough space around you can bring in the soil or bring it up. That may be the only place in some of the unincorporated areas where you'll see development. I think you see some of that even as you go along some of the corridors and some of the other counties. But I think it's an important conversation, without getting into detail today, to have for this council to you know, as members, to certainly ask us questions, because these policies will have great impact and of great import not only to the Delta, but certainly to, I think, to the long-term viability of whatever pursuits, certainly some of those are defined in the law, but also the pursuits that will go back to the economic sustainability and some of the support services that come from the secondary zone in particular. But, again, for today's purpose, I think you've certainly delineated, the issues, and some of these are spark plugs for certain folks, but for today's purpose, I think you've got a good identification of the issues that need to be addressed.
Randy.
Gwen, on page 9, the last bullet point under protect and enhance unique cultural values, this will probably seem like a picky point, but that last bullet point I don't think is a finding. I think it's better.
Which page?
Page 9.
No, there's a couple that had an errant 9 floating around.
Oh, I'm sorry, 9-4. Thank you.
Sorry about that, too.
Yeah, but it's the first section in that... in that area. It's the last finding, comprehensive regional planning based on coordinated local efforts. That's more of a policy than a finding.
Okay, other comments on this? I think ultimately this presents a choice to the council that's really difficult. The statute highlights the four ingredients that at least the legislature and governor thought were the definition of Delta: cultural, recreational, natural resources, ag value. And the one thing all the evidence I've seen indicates is if you begin to urbanize, agriculture disappears. That seems to be the pattern in California. PPIC has some charts on that on a statewide basis. So one of the things we're going to have to ask the locals is, I know everyone cares about agriculture, but the question is, do they care about it more or less than development? Because if the primary zone of the Delta is protected for a host of reasons, it's not long protected if the entire secondary zone gets swallowed up over 40 years by urban development. Then it becomes, regretfully, something like boutique agriculture in a relatively small place. And of course, that's one of the threats and challenges, but the uniqueness of the Delta. It's virtually surrounded by large urban areas, and it is a rural area that has, for a host of reasons, mainly because, I think, because the flood risks are so high, it has not developed. But if you directly or indirectly encourage development, you put a whole slug of people into an area and expose state liability. But more important, agriculture is under pressure. It's kind of the old line,
Well, sure, I moved. I knew it was a farm next door, but you never told me you were going to have tractors and spraying and all the old stuff that goes with it. Anyway, I thought this has a lot of meat in this chapter. Anything else anybody wants to pick up on? Randy.
As a policy of the state, if you want to use agriculture to provide a green belt between development and recreation, in this case, and you want to preserve that area in agriculture, there's some economic world-driven drivers that work against some people in agriculture existing. So there are ag land conservation trusts that have been formed to serve as a supplement to the property owners to maintain that in an agricultural perspective as an alternative to what Pat suggested, that you're in trouble, you try and find a higher value for what you're doing. Oftentimes urbanization is that avenue. So we probably need to say something about ag land trusts, ag land conservation, if we are treating agriculture as greenbelt. Because we can't, there's no policy in the state that can force a farmer to continue losing money for very long.
If I could just add to that, I think there's, it ties back to the discussion about levies, because, again, those same agricultural lands, the particular areas where you have the rural setting, they're responsible, at least in many cases, for the assessments that support the reclamation districts that provide the matching dollars or a lot of the dollars to maintain those levies. And that's not in all cases, but certainly in a lot of those cases.
Right.
They also are the base, as small as it may be, for underpinning for your local school districts, for what property taxes are generated. And I think that, counties can speak to this, but you have in addition to the matrix of levies, you have roads on many of those levies that are, maintained by local jurisdictions. You have certainly state highways, but and so the dollars that are generated, and if if agriculture flounders and or you go to a situation of habitat, and if there's not provisions for, again, it goes to property tax in lieu policies, then your local governments, whether it's counties and maybe some cases cities, and certainly your reclamation districts, they're going to struggle because the dollars don't flow to them for their purposes, which are utility, and law enforcement falls in that category as well. So, I mean, it is tied to, how, and again, I think the Economic Sustainability Plan hopefully will provide some insight into those issues. And I think, as Randy said, you can't force them to keep farming, and we're seeing some generational breaks right now because of the difficulty for lots of different reasons. And I think that, one of the last point I make is that one of the key things, and I've experienced as a local official and just in the last year or two, is with the FEMA regulations, where the door is going to shut here pretty suddenly on Grand Island and a few other places, where people are trying to build support structure for processing of products that are grown and produced in the Delta and trying to beat the clock so they can get those facilities in place. Otherwise, we lose that. And so then your trucking costs go up and all the other things, and it becomes even more difficult for folks to continue farming in the Delta. So, there's a lot of pieces to this, and I don't want to go on much longer than I have already, but I just would note those as being other key drivers in this.
Okay. All right. Anything else on this chapter? Okay. Gwen, the other chapters, 10, 11, and 12, are pending. What would you want us to say something about that we haven't said anything about, that we're willing to say something about?
Well, all of the above, if there's, because as we'll be reworking those, and if there's anything in there that you want to make sure we see, or that would be great.
Okay. Well, let's do this. You're going to go through another one of these. We're in the frenzy of preparation for the next draft, which will drive everyone crazy. Will you get some sleep at night, please, Ms. Buchholz? And then we'll see the next product. This is a good start. Mm-hmm. I think it's a really terrific idea if you get a couple of the chapters in shape earlier than a month from now to release them early. I know it fragments the discussion, but I think it just is really important to give people as much time as you can. And unless I'm mistaken, our next meeting in early March is at the Old Mill again, right?
That's correct.
Okay, so we'll be down in the Delta. So anyway, whatever you can do would be appreciated on that. After we get testimony, Joe, I'd like to just wind back up with your estimation of what you collectively think is going to be, or maybe you should tell us now, that next 2 day session is, you call it briefing session or something like that. We won't have the new Delta plan draft then.
We will not, but my expectation is that we will talk more about findings, and we'll also then talk some about the policies and let people talk about the potential policy areas and give us their input on what they think they would like to see in the next version of the plan. I should mention on governance and finance, two chapters that we'll have next time, what I'm anticipating will be in them. In the governance chapter, there are really two things. One is, how do we manage the Delta plan itself? What are the kinds of things that the council needs to do, the internal kind of governance things there? A second thing would be recommendations to the legislature for governance. So I'd expect that that will be part of the governance section. For finance, I would expect we'd want to talk about at least three different layers, and maybe more than that, of governance. One is, how do you pay for the council, the conservancy, the Delta Protection Commission on a short-term basis? How do you pay for all of the elements of the Delta plan moving forward in increments? Frankly, I'd be happy to get through 2025 even. I'd be happy to get through 5 years even. But how do you pay for those things in different time segments, right, the way we've split up the time segments going forward, and kind of looking at different groups of kinds of expenses, the basic expenses for the council, the basic expenses for implementation of ecosystem and other things. And so I expect we'll have a lot in those chapters. In the end, for finance, I would expect that also will include then recommendations to the legislature about how we proceed.
Think also about Don's request, and I think the council agrees, to ask the cities and counties to come in to talk specifically about land use at an appropriate time. I'm not sure what the time is, because you're going to have to do some preparation of background material, Pat's suggestions on questions, factual questions, which I think is a wise...
Agreed.
And then you'll have to negotiate with all the cities
Well, if we could get the information, ideally we'd have it for you 2 weeks from now. I'm not sure that we can,
but we can try. That's your call, but it's going to have to be soon, clearly. Okay. Just last point, Gwen, I just wanted to, on the matrix of comments that have been received in the last month, I'd noted that the Farm Bureau had sent a whole bunch of letters, mostly criticizing the Delta Water Master for his report that was given to the Water Board, copy to us. And I'd noted that the comment, status of comment, the comment will be used in the development of the Delta plan. I read it as agreeing with the comments, because we've done that. And I'm told that that might not be exactly the artful way to express it. In other cases, we simply say will be considered. And I don't know,
should be considered. Yeah. I apologize for that.
My recommendation is, as you review this matrix, you probably want to send a letter to the people who made the comments. It wasn't just Farm Bureau. There were a couple of other groups, too. And explain to them it'll be considered. It's not a representation that it's formally going to be adopted, because there'd be a big argument about that if they were. Okay. Anything else? Felicia, excuse me.
I know I ran through that list of things I wanted, the regional stuff and all that. But if we can also think about, I know this is hard, as we go through this stuff, to add in, and this is different from financing plan, the actual costs of things, estimates, so that we have some orders of magnitude on what certain policy suggestions would cost versus others. Okay. I think that's going to be very helpful on us being able to make some decisions on policies.
Okay, anything else? All right. Anyone in the audience like to speak to us? Pat, if I can have... Thank you very much. Mr. Zlotnick.
Mr. Chairman, Council Members, Greg Zlotnick, State and Federal Contractors. First of all, I want to say I very much appreciate the difference between today's session and yesterday's session, in terms there was a lot more of you
presented today in terms of your thoughts on the various chapters and things, and that's very useful and informative for us to hear that. And so I encourage continuing that, which I know is the intent. And I just have to say that I felt Felicia's pain. I remember one of my early days as a board member with a big old EIR. When do I get to comment on it? You know, and how do you get that in a way that's efficient for everybody else? And so I appreciate that very much. I'm mainly up here, though, not surprisingly, after Mr. Grindstaff's comment, I could not let that pass. Had to pull my head off the wall. And just a few things. I do appreciate you, though, Joe, putting it on the table. If that's how you're thinking, then it's very important that it be out there so we can start having some conversations. But if, in fact, the contracts for exports are covered actions, quote-unquote, and accepting for the moment that that is the case, although I think we would strongly disagree, then we assume that that would also apply to any diversion upstream of the Delta, potentially any new license or anything else as well that could have an impact, which we also think is, in addition to your comment, that would not be consistent with the statute in the sense that under Section 85031D, it specifically points out that nothing in the Act is to essentially affect state board jurisdiction at all unless specifically called out, and we would say that that's not. And then under 85032I, it's not to affect any water right, period. And so we think there's implications there. And certainly you get into issues, well, what's the relationship of that kind of a potential discussion of a covered action and the state board's role in all of that, and how would that happen? So I would hope that perhaps maybe either internally or with some paperwork and that would discuss that, because it could potentially be a huge diversion, if you will, to discussion and controversy and things that really aren't at the core of what you're to do, but which would have to be dealt with if, in fact, you're going that direction. It may not be as productive as we might hope. Similarly,
Yes, Ms. Marcus.
This is just something I've been struggling with to think about. Again, it gets somewhat to that programmatic level. Part of what the Delta Plan is supposed to do is inform all of the other decision-making.
Mm-hmm.
So the question might be, how would the Water Board, for example, take into account the overall Delta Plan? Mm-hmm. Because even in doing the contracts, I mean, there's been litigation about it at some level, you're not supposed to do it in a vacuum,
sure,
of everything else that's going on, the Delta Plan being one piece of what's going, mm-hmm, on. So, mm-hmm, I think the devil's in the details about what consideration actually means.
Yeah.
So there's a conversation to be had so that if an agency was going to renew the contracts without any token look at what's happened since, because that's part of what you have to look, mm-hmm, at what happened since. The Delta Plan is something that's happened since. You'd want to have some hook to say, hey, wait a minute, guys, you're kind of missing, you're,
sure,
missing the boat,
sure,
here.
And
but
it
could also be with the particular agency. It could be with the Water Board. So, mm-hmm, you've identified a really interesting, mm-hmm, thicket. So
right.
I think that's important to throw into the mix as we think about what to do. But ignoring contracts or upstream, I think, is a also a tough place for us, because if you do it like this, mm-hmm, there's a...
Right, and I want to be clear.
So I'm not sure how to handle
the issue. I mean, your points are very well taken and legitimate in terms of the plan and how does the plan, which, as we know, is intended to help shape state policy.
Yeah.
The question here is the whole issue of equating that with a covered action subject to the process of appeals and all that here, rather than sort of like what we talked about yesterday on the water resources side, where there's a difference between, you know, provide and promote and manage in the statute. And the issue is the council has certainly a role to put together a plan to help, I believe the words are, guide state actions, if you will, but it leaves the jurisdictional issues to those other entities that have the authorities. And that's part of the issue here. We know that we have to work within the system with the state board and everything else and the fish agencies, and we do that. And the question is, what is the appropriate role for, as you described, the Delta Plan and sort of guiding or informing those processes, which is a very different than a notion of a regulatory power located here with the council on an appeal under covered action situation. And so that's really the issue. And related to that, and I know Mr. Fiorini and other, we've talked repeatedly here about it being a legally enforceable and regulatory plan. And would just point out that from our view, that really with the exception of the appeals process for covered actions, which is where your real regulatory authority and legally enforceable role comes in terms of hearing appeals of consistency, if you're going to get into other areas of the plan and talk about those or frame those as regulations, whether it be on water conservation, groundwater, whatever, we would be very interested in Mr. Stevens' judgment on whether or not the exemption under 85.225.30, which applies to the administrative appeals procedure in terms of the exemption from the government code, would apply to all such possibly proposed regulations. We don't think there is an exemption for that sort of thing within the statute, and if you're going to go down that path, then there's a whole other area of administrative law and other things you'd have to deal with. So we caution against that as well, because in the statute it seems very clear that that exemption from the government code is for the administrative appeals process set up to deal with covered actions only. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Rentz from Aqua.
Good morning. Mark Rentz, Association of California Water Agencies. First of all, just a quick comment on your webcast. I was not able to attend yesterday's meeting, but I do have a furnace now, so I'm glad that I didn't attend yesterday's meeting. But I would listen to the webcast all day long while I was at home, and it's excellent. I just wanted to give you that feedback. I was able to hear everything, and I appreciate, Mr. Chairman, when you ask people to step a little closer to the mic.
That's a useful reminder, because I've never gone back and watched the videotape, but I think remind me of that. We ought to remind everybody again, whether it's me or Mr. Stevens, who leans back in his chair when he talks, or witnesses, because the sound is not automatically understandable. We got to work at it.
But it is a very good tool. I just thought you should have that feedback. I'm going to just give some quick three general comments that I got from listening yesterday, and especially today, and maybe even a little quick fourth one that came out of the discussion that just preceded me. And we'll be obviously submitting to you in time for the March 10th, 11th meeting some of our more specific thoughts that we can share with you at that time and beforehand, so you have a chance to digest them a little bit. First of all, I'd like to say that the approach that you laid out, Hank, about the three points, you know, what is it you want to do, why do you want to do it, how do you want to do it, you know, that may sound simplistic, but really, given the complexity of what you're taking on, I think that's a very, very good initial skeletal approach that really allows you to be succinct, which leads me to my first point. My suggestion is when you look at, to go back and look at the findings and look for opportunities to be more succinct with them as opposed to so extensive in your description. Some of those findings are 3-4 lines long, and you kind of lose what the point is you're trying to say in there. For example, there's one at the top of page 6.5 that could really be narrowed down to, it talks about the effects of contaminants from municipal, et cetera, et cetera. I didn't bring the language up here with me. But really the gist of that finding is contaminants adversely affect native food web. And if you can just get to that point and then have a little more, leave the discussion down below, it really grabs me as the reader's attention and holds me rather than getting lost in the verbiage and I sometimes don't even find my way through the subsequent paragraphs. Just a thought. On the third point that Mr. Nordhoff raised about how do we do what we want to do, and goes to Mr. Fiorini's comments and a couple that Mr. Eisenberg had, and I'm going to use an example that's very that I'm very well aware of because of my previous position. Yesterday there was a good discussion with US EPA on the concern with pesticides, most notably pyrethroids, and there's been discussions previously. There was some today when your chief scientist was up here. But I noticed in all those discussions, and I was very surprised, especially by US EPA's comments, there was no discussion about what the Department of Pesticide Regulation is doing currently with pyrethroids. And the only reason I bring that up is it's in reevaluation. The whole country's watching that reevaluation right now, including US EPA at the Washington level. The reason I bring that forward as an example is, as you start gelling on some of these concerns, stressors, one of the things, it goes to the financing aspect that you raised, Phil, and how do we get from analysis to solutions that you raised, Randy, is I encourage you to start looking at where are there authorities, responsibilities, regulatory oversight that you might be able to take advantage of. It goes back to the comment that the discussion Greg and Felicia just had about that. It's not that I'm saying that's not something that shouldn't be discussed, but where you can farm it off to a parking lot and say, we've recognized this as a concern, and these are the authorities where it can be handled, you might create some efficiency of scale for the plan. And my final point I wanted to suggest is there's been a lot of discussion, a lot of efforts attempted to prioritize the stressors, and my only thought on that is everybody's been very challenged by that, and that's because we kind of have a tendency to look at the stressors in isolation from each other, look at the individual stressors, analyze them, where do they fall on the list. Perhaps one of the things we want to have a discussion about as this plan starts to evolve is, are there opportunities for looking at an integration of actions that address more than one stressor? That gives you some flexibility, gives you some opportunity to do some give and take. Maybe by addressing one stressor, it takes a little heat off of another stressor. I don't have any specific ideas in mind, but that allows you some flexibility and also lets you to put into play the timing aspect of some of these. Some of these things you can do early on, and it gives you some breathing space until you get to another stressor down the road. So I just wanted to throw that out there as an idea, and thank you again for the opportunity. Good.
Mr. Rentz, thank you. Valerie Kincaid, the San Joaquin River Group. Ms. Kincaid.
Valerie Kincaid with San Joaquin River Group. We're similar to Aqua, San Joaquin River Group is going to submit detailed written comments, and I'm not going to go through those here now. I did want to echo one or two of the points that came up earlier, specifically the point about stressors. The River Group thinks that is a pretty small section and a pretty big issue. So our comments will hopefully address that, but we think that's certainly one of the sections that needs to be beefed up and more detail added. Another point that Randy touched on are illegal diversions, and I think not only does that play into the ecosystem, but you kind of get double your money on that because it's also a reliability issue. So I personally think that should go in both sections, both the water reliability and the ecosystem improvement. I think that ties into both. And like I said, we're going to submit written detailed comments. I also have a question about the process moving forward, and this is not really a comment, it's more for guidance, and perhaps Joe can and provide some guidance on this. The 10th and 11th workshop, the San Joaquin River Group is interested in participating in that to the extent possible, but I'm unclear at this point about how that works. Do we put panel members forward? How are we going forward with that? I don't know if there's more information that I've missed or if it hasn't been put out there yet, but my understanding is that I don't know how to move forward with panels.
There are panels being put together. I don't know where they're at in the process. If you talk to Keith Coolidge, I think he's still here, then he can help you with that.
Great. And is that a stakeholder-included
yes,
panel group?
Yes, stakeholders, science. We're going to try and have various different kinds of panelists. So we'll include stakeholders as well as specialist experts, if you will.
Okay, great. I'll talk with him. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Anyone else in the audience like to speak to us? Okay, members, thank you very much for doing this. The next meetings will be as long, if not longer. Mr. Grindstaff, anything to add? Ms. McCauley, anything to add? Ms. Buchholz, anything to add? Okay, thank you very much. Meeting adjourned.